Ellis versus Ellis.
Deborah?
Please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Aaron Bishop. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Philip Ellis. Since my time is brief, I guess I wanted to start with a simple statement that I could about this case, which is, at the time that these two people entered into an agreement that dissolved their marriage, Ms. Ellis had never worked, did not work, and was not working at the time that they entered into the agreement. They imputed income to her of just over $1,600. But all the money that she was getting for support in any capacity at that point, at the time that they entered into the agreement, was $2,600. In the appellee's brief, they cite very clearly that the evidence that was adduced at trial was that she was earning over $2,800 a month from an employment that she had achieved after the divorce, after the settlement agreement. She testified at the trial that she received no specific education or training in order to achieve that job, and she testified that she had no information, no idea, no concern that her medical conditions that had kept her from working during the marriage were going to return. I think the reason that we decided so early after the decision was rendered to file our appeal was the nature and the focus of the court's determination. In its conclusion, not about child support, that's where the last paragraph is before the conclusion, but in its conclusion about our alimony argument, the court focuses on the idea that it would have been Mr. Ellis's burden to prove, to offer some evidence, to show that the medical condition was not going to return. I could not find that standard supported anywhere, that we have to prospectively look forward at a medical condition and ask or show the court to find that it cannot return. I don't even know if that medical evidence would have been available. The testimony was at the time of trial that at the time the settlement agreement was entered into and at the time of trial, she didn't know what the diagnosis was. It was something related to blood clots and asthma, but it was not an issue. It had never been officially diagnosed, although they had traveled extensively to multiple doctors to do so. It had never been diagnosed. So offering evidence to show that an undiagnosed illness would not return, I don't think is a standard that should be placed on anyone.
Was that the only reason given by the trial court, though, in denying your application?
It was not.
Let's assume that we can ignore that if we agree with you in our de novo review. What's your next best argument that the court abused its discretion if we ignore that medical situation?
Absolutely. I think it's what I started with. I think the next best argument is alimony is for maintenance and support of an individual who doesn't otherwise have it without getting back into the work field and getting training and experience. She is now making more than she was being supported by at the time of that the settlement agreement was entered into. And keep in mind, she was still getting child support. So the $2,800 that she is earning is more than what she was necessarily needing at the time that they entered into their settlement agreement, and she was still getting child support above and beyond that. That does not even take into account the residual income that she's now getting. At the time of trial, the testimony was that she has maintained an interest in the business that her husband, ex-husband, used to work for. Her father owned a business. He sold the business but maintained the property. She had an interest in the business while they were married. It was sold. Everyone testified. The accountant, the father-in-law, the ex-wife, and Mr. Ellis all testified that he was not included, had no knowledge of the sale of the business, what was going to transpire, what interest he was or wasn't keeping. Everything that happened, that was the end of their marriage. The end of their marriage was when she came home and said, "My father's selling the business. I'm going to get $384,000 from the sale." Him saying, "What are we going to do with the money?" And she says, "No, it's going to be mine. Our marriage is over." He agreed to allow her to keep that money and to find that money as non-marital as part of his agreement.
So if he knew all that before the dissolution, let's take a step back even further. What are we looking for? What's our standard? Since this was, it's a modification, which is typically a material change in circumstances.
Yes.
However, this was an agreed upon property settlement. So doesn't that change it to whether there's been fraud or gross inequity?
I don't think that it goes so far as having to show fraud or gross inequity. I think the case law is clear that it's held to a higher standard, that there's going to be more, the necessity of more of a showing of a material change in circumstance. And I'm not alleging that Ms. Ellis perpetrated fraud on her husband by saying that I can't work. I have an undiagnosed illness that keeps me from working. But I do think that the standard should be that even when held to that higher standard, that when there is this much of a change, someone who never worked during a 20-year marriage, who now is making $16.40 an hour and working 40 hours a week, there was no evidence, there was no testimony that was interfering with her abilities to parent children, which is one of the standards that the court is supposed to look at. There was no evidence that she had to get additional training or experience. She merely decided to enter the workforce, and the medical restrictions that were apparently present throughout the marriage were no longer a restriction on that. I think it's also relevant that he was not included, and there was no reference to the interest that she was going to maintain in her father's property after the marriage.
But didn't all that happen before the dissolution?
The sale of the business happened before the settlement agreement. His understanding that he was maintaining the building, that he was maintaining an income interest in the building as a rental property, and that she was going to maintain a 17% interest in that rental interest, was not disclosed to him prior to the agreement. It appears nowhere in the property statement. It appears nowhere in the settlement documents. He did not know that she was going to be making money off the rental property. In fact, the evidence was that the $6,000 that was initially was the only payment that happened prior to the settlement agreement. It actually happened within weeks of the settlement agreement being signed and the divorce being finalized. So they were separated for over a year. He had gone and actually started a new company, was working as a competitor by the time that the settlement agreement was finalized. And so there was not that disclosure. So she was getting $1,000 a month from residual income. She is now making more than her entire support that she was getting at the time of the divorce. And frankly, I haven't even spoke about it yet, but the judge denied his opportunity to review her financial circumstances. We don't know what she was getting from the $384,000 that she was allowed to invest.
That was known before the settlement agreement.
It was, but we weren't allowed to receive that in discovery. We weren't allowed to look at her bank statements. We weren't allowed to see.
How would that be a change in circumstances?
Well, I think if she's living in a 5-bedroom home on one of the nicest portions of Grand Island, and it's not a home that she was forced to purchase, it's a home that her father purchased for her, and she testified that she was paying $650 a month for that property, that's well below the market rates.
Well, that's in evidence. That's not anything you were denied being able to present.
Right, but we weren't able to actually verify that that's what was happening. Her father testified that he didn't know how much she was paying. He also testified he didn't know how much property taxes were, although he testified that he was paying it. So we weren't able to see if she was taking distributions from that investment account. We weren't able to see if she was getting distributions from that investment account. We weren't able to see if she was getting other in-kind benefits. She testified that while he was married to her and they were, he was employed by her father-in-law, that there were benefits that he received in kind as an employee that were extended to his family. We don't know if those were continuing because we were denied the opportunity to review any of those economic things for no reason. I say that literally. The court literally said that the rest of our motion to compel was denied and gave no explanation for why that wouldn't be relevant at looking at the economic circumstances, which is the standard for an alimony.
Yes. Well, it is in the initial determination of alimony. I would agree that all of those things would have been appropriate. But if those things pre-existed the settlement agreement, I guess I'm having a hard time seeing why that information would lead to proving a material change in circumstances or whatever the standard is in this case.
I think it would all go to the relative economic circumstances, continued maintenance or support of either of the parties. I think that when an individual has never been employed and is continuing to receive in-kind benefits and is now employed and has residual income and is still getting child support, I think the relative economic circumstances have changed. When you add to that the fact that it's possible, I don't know, we don't know, it's possible that she wasn't paying rent. It's possible that she wasn't having to pay for her cell phone. It's possible that she was getting other distributions from her father that are not in the record because we weren't allowed to look at her economic circumstances. We weren't allowed to discover what was in her bank accounts. We weren't allowed to discover what was being done with her investment income that she did receive as a portion of settlement. I think it's very telling that Mr. Ellis received an equalization payment from Ms. Ellis with $384,000 excluded. So even with $384,000 excluded from the marital estate as non-marital property, he still received a payment from her. Their economic circumstances were fairly set, other than the fact that she was not working. She was not making money, and now she is. If that's not, if making more than you were required to have for necessary support, if making more than that with a job that you've never had before that required no additional training and experience, I don't know when there would ever be the standard met for a modification. This isn't supposed to equalize their incomes. It doesn't matter. The focus of the court and of the appellee in this case seems to be that Mr. Ellis was perhaps making a little bit more. Mr. Ellis never argued that. Never argued. I mean, we did put on his tax returns. We did argue about what he was actually receiving from his employment. But we never actually argued he's making more. That was not the focus of our case, that he was making less. Our argument was that he was making less, but that was not the focus of our argument. Our argument was focused on her change in economic circumstances.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How long can we take, Mr. Bishop?
59 seconds.
Would you add that to the if you desire another 59 seconds?
Yes. May I interrupt?
Yes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Erin Schroeder. I represent Jennifer Jardine, formerly known as Jennifer Ellis, the appellee of the there are four assignments of error in this case that can be distilled down to two legal issues: a discovery issue and a modification issue. With respect to the discovery issue, the district court did not commit an abuse of discretion in partially denying appellant's motion to compel discovery.
They only allowed the tax returns, correct?
On the order granting motion to compel, they ordered production of It's All Relative LLC's tax returns, which is the family business's tax returns. So appellant did have that. So those were produced.
So what about the other things that you just heard him list off?
So those items were interrogatory number six, first, information pertaining to an Ameritrade account. That was an investment made, as we discussed, prior to the dissolution of marriage. Furthermore, in his brief, appellant cites to exhibit, I believe, 11 at page 3, which is Appley's tax return. In that tax return, there is income disclosed from investment accounts such as this. So the very information that appellant says was not compelled or was not provided in discovery was provided because he had Appley's tax returns for 2015, 16, and 17. He also had the tax returns for It's All Relative LLC. Same with interrogatory number 90, that was another one. Information pertaining to the balance of bank accounts on the date of the divorce and the date of signing interrogatories. If the allegation is that she was making more income that was going into those bank accounts, it would follow that income was being reported in the tax returns, which were provided in discovery. Therefore, appellant cannot show that he was prejudiced by the court's failure or denial of this motion to compel. The other information was whether Appley disposed of, received, or transferred assets as a gift during the past 3 years. If the allegation is that Appley disposed of assets as a gift, that would not be relevant to the allegation that her income had increased, right? If she had received gifts, that would be a temporary increase in circumstances. And this court has held in Collins versus Collins, 19 of Act 529, that a change in circumstances cannot be temporary in order to sustain a modification like this.
Okay, you mentioned a change in circumstances. What's our standard here? Is it still a material change in circumstance, or given the fact that there was a settlement agreement, do we then just look to fraud or whether there's first thing?
To answer your question, no agreement, I do have Lawson v. Lawson in support of the proposition that although this court has the authority to modify consent decrees, we have held that a consent decree is usually treated as an agreement between the parties, and it is afforded greater force than ordinary judgments and ordinarily will not be modified over an objection of one of the parties. Obviously, Appley objects to the modification in this case because it's not appropriate in light of the fact that there has not been a material change in circumstances.
What about her going to work? mean, it's not not a material change. She's making a substantial amount of money when she hasn't worked at all prior.
At the time of trial, she had been employed for 3 weeks working full-time at an hourly rate. She was not going to work as an accountant or a doctor. She was a woman newly out of the workforce after 20 years of marriage, having not ever worked before her marriage. So while she was making money that way, Abilene testified during trial, so she had never worked during the course of the marriage. She testified the parties understood at the time of the divorce settlement that alimony would compensate her for the lost opportunity to work. She also testified the need to work was precipitated in part by a need for health insurance for her son. A parallel case for Hovind versus Verhovind, the parties anticipated in that case that the recipient of alimony would obtain full-time employment. And in that case, it was an abuse of discretion to find that that increased income as a result of employment.
Where's the anticipation in this one, though? I mean, she had never worked before. I didn't see anything in the record that indicated either of the parties anticipated she'd be able to return to work, much less on a full-time basis.
Sure. The anticipation, I believe that's borne out in the testimony. There was testimony in the record, and I can find the site if needed. But when asked, I believe there was testimony in the record that she would be returning. There was testimony in the record that this would compensate her for the lost work during the marriage.
And when a similar question was asked, didn't the judge say that's irrelevant, it doesn't matter? And I think he let the other party answer that question.
And I apologize, which question, Ann?
About what the intent of the party's intent for alimony was. I think the judge said it doesn't matter.
Later on, I do believe he sustained an objection on that basis during Appley's case in chief.
But isn't alimony for the continued maintenance of the former spouse into the future?
Yes, I agree.
And here the argument is their relative economic circumstances have changed by virtue of her going to work full time, and a pretty substantial increase in her income or imputed income at the time of the divorce versus actual income at the time of trial.
And so I'm glad you bring that up, because that brings me to the point that there were material miscalculations in appellant's brief regarding both parties' income. Specifically, so appellee's income at the time of the modification, appellant attributes over $14,000 of distributions to her income. And as Terry Galloway testified, the LLC is a flow-through entity, and the members have to report their share of income and deductions on their own returns. The $14,756 that appellant attempted to add to Appley's income is not, as explained by Terry Galloway, income that in fact goes to appellant. He was specifically asked, is that income that goes to Ms. Jardine? And he answered no. That is income that was reported on her K-1 as a distribution. The actual rental income, the rental income from the property that was being leased out, that was income that went to Ms. Jardine. So that is appropriate to include in her income.
The district court used about $4,800 for her income, if I have that correct.
I'm sure you do, yes.
Well, I'm not sure. I guess it's a question. But do you dispute that figure as being accurate or inaccurate?
I can have one moment.
I believe it's page 78 of the transcript.
Yes.
And page 4 of the court order is the 48,650.
We do dispute that. Our calculation on page 9 of our brief is that the average of the past 2 years, she was receiving about $1,972 a month.
Well, that average would not have included her new employment income then.
Average of the past 2 years. If she began, correct.
Because I understood you to say that she started the job 3 weeks before the modification trial?
She started her full-time job 3 weeks before the modification trial. Before that, she was employed about 30 hours a week for GI Family Radio. Furthermore, if the modification was filed, the modification in this case being filed I believe, it was certainly filed before she started working full-time. So on that basis, there was not a material change in circumstances based on her income, at least working full-time at the time the modification, when her modification was filed. I do want to touch on some of the evidence pertaining to appellant's income.
Before you go there, and I want to ask you a question about the court's apparent requirement to prove the appellant, for the appellant to have the burden of proof that the income of the appellee was going to continue into the future.
So as pointed out earlier, this was not the only basis for the court's opinion, although I do acknowledge that paragraph.
Would you agree that there's no precedent or no case law that would support a requirement upon the appellant to prove that?
I would agree with that, but I would also note the holding from the case I cited earlier that says a temporary change in circumstances is not a substantial basis to modify a decree, especially a consent decree, as it was in this case. And that case, again, was Collins versus Collins. A temporary change in circumstances cannot be a basis for a motion to modify, and at the time of trial, she had only been employed full-time for 3 weeks.
But there wasn't evidence that it was a temporary job, I take it.
No, and she did testify she intended to hold that job as long as she could. She also testified that her improvement was due to a new shot she was receiving. And so to that, and I don't believe that this was an undiagnosed condition, as the Bronx keeps characterizing it. She was receiving treatment for it, and therefore it would have had to be diagnosed by a medical professional in some capacity. With respect to appellant's income, appellant alleges his income essentially decreased when he went to work for what the business he now owns is a partial owner of, Hydro Irrigation. One large error in those calculations is the Section 179 income. He did not use the straight line method required by the child support guidelines, and that's set forth in my brief. Unless there are any questions about that, I would submit the issue, the remaining issues on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted and the counsel is excused. Next case, State versus Ortega. State versus Ortega.